All right, so we are Shmuel Aleph Perek Aleph. We have now talked about Elkanah. We've talked about the pilgrimage to Yerushalayim, the pilgrimage to the Mishkan in Shiloh, two different ways to look at it, whether this is part of Aliyah LeRegel, not part of Aliyah LeRegel, the question of where the commentators get the idea that Elkanah is trying to influence others to get them to go to Shiloh. And we talked about Penina's relationship with Hannah and two different ways to look at that relationship. Either the read that Penina is really the victim, in the sense that she's brought into this household in which she's inferior from the start to Hannah. She's not the favored wife. She's not the achat that Hannah is. And she's miserable as she has a husband who is paying much more attention to her rival, and she's lashing out. And that's one way to look at it. And the other way to look at it is that she's actually righteous in trying to get Hannah to daven, because as you see, Hannah doesn't daven every year when they get to there. She doesn't go to the Mishkan every year. This is unique. Now, finally, Hannah goes to the Mishkan to daven, and she feels much better, and she accomplishes something by doing so. So in this way of painting it, Penina is actually the one who moves Hannah to do something about her situation, which, I don't think it's still... I don't think it takes care of all of our problems. At the end of the day, you still have the problem that she's torturing Hannah. But I think these are very interesting ways to look at her. Maybe you should try that first here. Okay. So what we have to do now is introduce Hannah, because we've said things about her, but we haven't really spent time focusing on who Hannah is, and she's about to go to the Mishkan. Right? We're up to Pasuk Tes, where she's going to actually go to the Mishkan, so we need to know more about her. What do we know about Hannah? Who is Hannah?
Okay,
Elkanah's wife.
Can't have children.
We know she's righteous. She identified as the achat, which we took that way, right? And we know that she's going to daven, and she's going to be answered. She cries in misery over her inability to have children. What's the difference between the way we introduce Hannah in the story and the way that we introduce Elkanah in the story?
Genealogy.
Right, and welcome back, Roberta. Excellent. Elkanah is from a long line, and he's a Levi, by the way. We know nothing about Hannah's backstory. For him, right. Well, we made that point on the Achad, that it's like the Ish Achad for him, correct. But we don't get a backstory for Hannah. Now, that's not unique to Hannah in terms of the lineage. Right, meaning in Tanakh, right, going back to that whole polygamy versus polyandry point, because you only have one male in a household and you have multiple females, the women join the husband's clan. That's the way it's going to work. So she's not going to be identified with her ancestors. She's identified as part of this new family, such that really Elkanah's heritage is her heritage. Effectively, she's part of their family, and so you don't really find other women in Tanakh being introduced with the names of their ancestors. Right? The closest I can come up with, I didn't do any searching, but the closest I can come up with is Elisheva, when she's introduced. So Elisheva is introduced as the daughter of Aminadav and the sister of Nachshon. And the Medrash is so impressed that we give this lineage that it says, yeah, why? Because if you're going to marry a woman, you want to check out what her brothers are like. And so we're mentioning that her brother is Nachshon, and that's what Aharon... Because the Medrash is surprised that we're giving this whole backstory about her. It is true, by the way, especially for hairline purposes. Very interesting note, because it goes from the mother. So you look at the mother's brothers, and that's how you know. Yeah. Very useful. But what it means to us is that she's introduced as a blank slate. Her whatever she's going to accomplish is not presented as the merit of her ancestors type of a thing. Her story is what we're going to see in front of us on the page.
Didn't we
also mentioned that the fact that these women were marrying him meant that they had elevated status, indicating that he is this top-notch guy and he is our main point, so he has this whole lineage, but she, on the other hand, she's not super important thing.
Well, we use that to analyze Penina, because we said, I don't know anything about Penina coming in,
right.
And all I know is this story about her, you know, torturing her rival, which makes her sound bad. However, if she's married to Elkanah and she's listed as being a rival to Penina, to Hannah, she must have some kind of level. In other words, it's not so much by dint of the marriage to Elkanah alone, it's being part of this framework. If we didn't have any knowledge of Hannah as a righteous person, I would weaken the case for Penina as well. I would look at it and say, well, maybe she's not so great, because after all, maybe, you know, both of them, maybe he just married down, so to speak.
Is there a medrash where Hannah's from?
Not that I'm familiar with. I'm not familiar with any sort of background at all. She is descended from so-and-so who merited to have Hannah descend from him, because I got nothing. It may be there. I just haven't seen it. Another thing, though, that we notice about Hannah, which I find to be very interesting, is that she's unassuming. Elkanah offers her extra portions, right? She declines. Elkanah tries to comfort her.
But how do you know
she doesn't respond? Because it says she won't eat.
Oh, she won't eat.
Yeah, the portions that he's giving her, she doesn't eat. Well, that's what males generally try to provide. You know, that's the way it goes. We're pretty much out of ideas after that.
But she does eat something. She arose after eating it.
Only that year. No, that's the point. Every year she doesn't. That year, because she went to the Mishkan and she was comforted by Eli, and that's what's different. Normally she does not eat. So she doesn't respond to being offered things. She doesn't respond to being offered comfort. And she also, we said, does not daven each year. And it's not that she thinks God can't do it. In other words, there are people who will not turn to God because they feel like, well, you know, what does that involve God? God doesn't do things like that, or they don't believe. But we're going to see very clearly in her tefillah and in her thanks afterwards that that's not the case. Hannah believes that God can do it, and in fact will. So so why doesn't Hannah daven?
Maybe she doesn't merit it.
That's what it looks like to me. She feels like she doesn't merit it, or that she doesn't want to ask for something for herself. And it's very consistent, because when she does daven for a child, what does she say is going to happen with the child? She's giving it to God. It's not about her. You know, she's not looking for personal gratification. And we grasp within the story, more than just her being unassuming and not wanting something for herself, we grasp that she is righteous. We saw it with the Achat, but it plays out in the story. The fact that she's willing to sacrifice for God means something to us. And I brought you source number one on the sheets. Chaim of Elazhin in his Nefesh HaChaim. A little bit of background on this book that we're quoting now, the Nefesh HaChaim, is probably important. Chaim of Elazhin was the chief Talmud, the chief student of the Vilna Gaon. So you're putting him at the end of the 18th century. He was the founder of what was ultimately the great Elazhin yeshiva. At this point in our history and in the place where he lives, you have a great battle going on between the Hasidim and the Misnagdim. But this isn't like Hasidim and Misnagdim of today. This is the early Hasidim. And the reason why that matters is because Hasidus has become very diluted. What it is today is not what it once was. In the early days of Hasidus, the polarization between Hasidim and Misnagdim was such that you found among the Hasidim people who said the only thing that matters is your relationship with God, is your intent for God, and that's it. So much so that they would say, don't do the mitzvah if you don't have the intent, or wait until the intent, the kavana, is present. Wait until you can really focus. And Rav Chaim of Elazhin writes his Nefesh HaChaim in part as a response to that. So he talks about people who, he won't name, but people who will end up eating in the sukkah on Pesach and eating matzah on Sukkot because they're waiting until they have kavana. So that's when they're going to do their mitzvah. And what he's doing is he's mocking Chassidus of his day. He is the arch misnagid. He's the arch misnagid, student of the Vilna Gaon, who was very staunch in his opposition to the Chassidim. Now, this isn't a class on Chassidim and misnagdim, which would be really the appropriate place to discuss the roots of the different ideas and how it played out. But even as Rav Chaim Volozhin's Nefesh HaChaim has within it a lot of the Kabbalah that the Hasidim also drew on, there's heavy mysticism in both, but he takes it in a very different direction. And one of the elements that he talks about is tefillah, the way we daven and what we're trying to accomplish when we daven. And for him, davening is not about, God, look at my needs. God, please take care of me. This is what's going on in my life. No. That's not where he is. As far as Rav Chaim Volozhin is concerned, the point of tefillah, the point of expressing to God, whatever we express about this world, is for God's sake. It's not about me. It's about Hashem. So that, as far as he's concerned, when a person turns to God and says, heal us, it's not send us a refuah or send us a parnasa or whatever it is because I need it, but because, God, you are unhappy when there is need down here. When people are suffering, Hashem, I know it makes you upset. So Hashem, knowing that this makes you upset, I am davening for you to take care of yourself by providing for us. Sounds convoluted. When you read it inside, it may be a little more clear. But take a look at number one, because Rav Chaim actually applies this to Chana. He says, "Hagam shehi atzma haitamar nefesh," even though she was personally of bitter spirit, as the text itself says, "al kol ze hishlicha tzara mineged," still, she threw away her pain. That wasn't her concern. She didn't care to daven for that at all. That wasn't her thing. Rather, she hurled her prayer before Hashem. She threw her prayer at God. And what he's talking about here is a phrase we're going to see in the Gemara. It's the Gemara's phrase. We have to get there. But his explanation of the Gemara's phrase is that she throws her prayer up to God, meaning she says, it's about you, Hashem. Alatzar shel mala hanasa machmas shishruya ata bitzar. He says, what Chana is doing is she's saying, Hashem, you're in pain because I am in pain. And so I'm asking you to take care of it for your sake, not for my sake. That's the way that he looks at it. And that's an element of the righteousness that we see within Chana. And ultimately, her tefillah is successful. Right? Hashem answers her. So we kind of assume, well, she must be righteous. And we're even going to learn halachos from her davening. There are all sorts of things that we do in our davening that are modeled on her that demonstrate, again, this confidence that Chana is not a random person. Chana is somebody with a lot to teach us. Clear? So what we've established then is, number one, Chana comes into the story as a blank slate. This is about her. It's not about her ancestry. Number two, that Chana is unassuming. She's not looking for things for herself. And three, that it's very clear that she is a righteous person.
And also maybe it shows that she might be a simple person, but at the same time, because of the strength of her Kavanah, she did get. So you don't have to be somebody who is related to or issued from our family. If you're a simple person or somebody who's not from an important family or whatever, and you have the right kavanah, you will get your wish.
So that's interesting. I'm not sure whether I would equate not coming from a great family with being simple. In other words,
I used the wrong word here. Not simple. It's simply not from an important family.
But she could be someone of great righteousness and so.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay. She also has a unique relationship with God. And we're going to see this play out in a few different ways. But number one, take a look at source two on your sheet. We know that there are seven names of God which you're not allowed to erase. The Mishnah in Shmuas tells us there are seven names of God that you're not allowed to erase. The usual ones that people think of are, of course, the four-letter name of Hashem, Yud, Hey, Vav, Hey. The ones that surround the form Aleph, Lamed, Hey, Elohim, Elokeinu, Elokecha, and so on. And then Shin, Dalet, Yud, right, is another one. And one of them is Tzadi, Beis, Aleph, Vav, Taf. It's a name of God. It's usually pronounced as Tzivaot. That's literally what it is.
So the 72 names.
No, that's not one of them. We're talking about normal names, not names that are extrapolated mystically. Not because those aren't real names of God, but because that's a different parsha. That's a whole other discussion when we do Kabbalah after Shmuel. Then we can go there. But in terms of this name, the literal meaning of this word is... Sorry? Not army, per se. It's come to mean army, but it's not. It's multitudes. Masses. Hosts, as they like to translate, right? Hashem Tzvakot, Lord of Hosts, is always the translation that you see. It isn't about how... Lord of Hosts is not... what it means is masses and multitudes. Tzavak comes to mean army in the Torah itself, in the Chumash itself, because it's masses of people. Where is the first time we find this word used in the Chumash? Not in Tzivos Hashem. Where is the first time we find this word appear in the Chumash? Come on, you know this.
Is this the word you mean?
Yes, except with an aleph instead of a kuf. But then you wouldn't be able to throw this out.
Right, and aleph instead of a
kuf.
Right.
What's the where is the first time you find this word show up in the Chumash? It's in Parshas Bereishis. You say it at least once a week.
Oh, the Kiddush.
Yeah.
Tzivaam.
Vayechulu Hashemayim v'haaretz v'chol tzivaam. Right? The heavens and the earth and all of their multitudes were completed. Right?
It can also be translated as army.
That's why it said to Diane that the army meaning comes from the meaning of multitudes. Yeah. It means the multitudes of God. Yeah, it for sure doesn't mean that is correct. So the point anyway is what you're going to see here in the Gemara. Amar Rabbi Elazar, Miyom Shabara Kadosh Baruch Hu es Olamo, from the time Hashem created his world, Lo Haya Adam Shekra'o La Kadosh Baruch Hu Tzvakos, no human being called God by this name. We don't find any person address Hashem using this. Hashem, the name is used beforehand. We even find it used before she does in Shmuel itself. We find it. If you look at Pasuk Gimel, right? Take a break from the Gemara for a second. Pasuk Gimel says, she went to Davin and to bring a carbon to Hashem Tzvakos. Mm-hmm. However, we don't find a person use that name for God until in her tefillah. When she davens, that's when it first happens. Ad shabasa chana v'kar ukra so tzvakos. Chana comes along and she calls Hashem by that name. So we're going to need to discuss more what she's doing by using that name. But on a very basic level, what does it mean to call God by this name in particular, Lord of Hosts?
Because maybe she wants a baby, so she says he's the God of multitudes.
Yes. No, that's it. That's exactly right. God, you are the God of multitudes. You are the creative God, right? So, new. Give me one of these svakos, in this case, that you create. It is also, though, a name that assigns complete control and ownership of the world to God. Right? The other names of God that we are familiar with speak of God as separate. Right? The other names that we know of for God, Hashem, Elokeinu, we can add prefixes or suffixes that give God an association with us, going from Elokim to Elokeinu, for example. But the other names seem to be more about Hashem as Hashem. This is one which speaks of Hashem in terms of his relationship with us.
Is it a plural?
So Elohim is plural. And even Adonai is plural. In general, we speak of God in the plural, not because God is plural. God is still singular, don't worry. But because it speaks of God as the royal we, the royal power, the one possessing all powers. And therefore, you know, that's the simplest explanation. You always get this funny medrash in Parshas Bereishis when the pasuk says that Hashem says, Na'aseh Adam. Right? So the Medrash asks, why is God suddenly speaking in the plural? Let us make man. So, yeah, you can give all sorts of answers, and the Medrash does, but the simple answer is because the name used for God throughout Parshas Bereishis is Elohim. Elohim is a plural name, reflecting all the powers and the royal we of it, and therefore it's Vayomer Elohim, Na'aseh Adam. But there's more to say on that, but it's not for right now. Chana expresses the belief that Hashem is the sole owner of what goes on in this world. All the different multitudes of the universe belong to God, and the strength of her commitment to that worldview, that view of the universe and that view of God, is seen when she davens. It's seen in the fact that she believes that her problem is God-related and God-solvable. You don't know if Chana is the one who says, when it says twice in the Psukim, Sagar Hashem Ba'ad Rachma, that God is the one who has closed up her womb. It's not just random, I can't have kids, but it's God preventing me from having children. You don't know if Chana is the one who's saying it, but you do know that she's the one who goes to daven. Ultimately, she turns to Hashem for it, and where you really see it is in the second parak, when she thanks Hashem for it, and she expresses explicitly her faith and her confidence that everything that happens is God. People get elevated, people are taken down, it's all God-based. So that's another element of her relationship with Hashem. Her relationship is more complicated than this, though. What we've said in her relationship is that she identifies God as the controller and owner of everything and so on. She's also a Nevi'ah. She's a prophet. And we're going to see her predict future events in a very interesting way. In addition to that, though, she's aggressive. And that's something you don't really see a whole lot of, and we're going to have to discuss. We might get to it this week, we might get to it next week. But her prayer to God is characterized in the Gemara as an aggressive prayer. Not, please, 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 God, give me a child, but, God, how dare you not give me a child? If you don't, you're going to be in trouble. Type of an approach. You'll see.
That doesn't fit the whole model of it. It's not,
but it starts out with it.
Well, it's all for you, but, you know, you're under threat, God, because if you don't do it for yourself, then, you know, you're going to suffer for it.
Sorry. And it's also,
she's so ready to be a Jewish mother.
It's a nidil. She really means it, because she's
got the kids.
Making an idea.
Yes, she makes the nether. Okay, so with this as a background, you know, just introducing us to Chana, let's take a look at what happens with her at the Mishkan. Starting in Pasuk Tes, sentence 9. Vatakam Chana, this is, as we said last week, where this year begins. Until now, we described what happened every year. Now we have it happened this year. Vatakam Chana, achrei ochla v'shilo v'achrei shaso. Chana got up after the eating and drinking, not her eating and drinking, because we already know that she didn't eat and drink, but after the meal was over. Ve'eli ha-kohen, yoshev al ha-kisei al mezuzas he-chal Hashem. And Eli the Kohen is sitting on the chair by the doorpost of the Mishkan. Ve'hi maras nafesh, and she, we already used the phrase before, was a bitter spirit. Vatispalel al Hashem, she davened, and she cried. Right, we've seen her crying before, she's crying again. Vatidor neder, and she took a vow. Vatomar, and she said, Hashem Tzvakos. Right, this is where you see that name used. Imra'o sir'eh ba'ani amasecha. If you will see the suffering of your maidservant, Uzchartani, and you remember me, Velosishkach es amasecha, and you don't forget your maid, right? That's a pairing that we see in a few other places in Chumash, we see it, right? Zachor and Al-Tishkach, Amalek is the classic, but also we find it Zachor Al-Tishkach es Asher in other places. V'nasatala amasacha zera anashim. If you will give your maidservant the seed of man, if you will give me a child, right? Your God way up there. Right, so it's not clear to me whether zera anashim means the seed of man, meaning a child, or whether it means that I would like to have a male child specifically, or whether it means a child of standing. You know, ish meaning somebody chashuv, somebody important.
JPS says male.
I don't understand the last.
JPS says male. Ish is used often in Tanakh to mean somebody of stature. Anashim is the plural of ish. The zera anashim doesn't just mean I want a kid. I want a kid who's going to be something. Yes. Yes.
Our Jesus.
Yes.
He's asking a lot.
Correct.
Impossible.
I want that one. Right.
Impossible.
You got it. Unsativ Lashem kol yemei chayav. But she says, if this happens, I'm going to give him to God for all his life. Umora lo ya'ale al rosho, and he will never shave.
So she's expecting a boy, because a girl wouldn't
have
had that.
Why? A girl can be a nazir. Yes. Nazirut is not male specific.
And she doesn't shave.
Well, also need hair cut. Also need hair. So that is her tefillah. There's more to say about her tefillah, but we're going to pause there, because there's already a lot going on here. First of all, well, let me just read the opening few words of the next pasuk, actually. You need that also. V'hayaki hir besali hispaleo. She was marbet. She did a lot of praying. Bailey shomeres pia, and Eli is watching her, and then the rest of the story happens, but that we don't need yet. What questions come up here, just from Sukim Tet to Yudbet, 9 to 12? What strikes us as interesting here?
It's not the normal type of request. She's not saying, please God, do this. It's like, if you do
she's
this
making
for
a
me,
deal.
I will... This child will be your child, basically.
It's deal making. Yes.
Yaakov made the same kind of prayer, right, to God? If you give me food and clothing and all.
Right. The difference is, what was Yaakov's if? What was Yaakov's not if? What was Yaakov's then?
Then
I'll give you 10%. Right? Yaakov is giving God a 10% cut.
She's giving everything.
She's giving everything.
So she doesn't want...
In the back of your mind, you're thinking about Yiftach and his daughter, right? And Yiftach saying, if we win this war, the first thing out of my house, Ali, see you, Allah, will be a burnt offering to God. Bad idea.
Why is it important?
What do you think? Diane asks, why do we need to know that she's Marat Nefesh? What do you think?
I was going to say that it...
Wait. What?
No, with this.
Yeah.
That it almost seems like she's not right in her head. Like, she's not in her right frame of mind. Like, I know we said that she didn't drink, but it says Marat Nefesh, and after she finished drinking, it almost sounds like she didn't drink. She's drunk and crazy right now.
Ailey thinks that she drank.
Yeah. Here. Right, but meaning, like, so with that word, they saying she drank.
But why would Marat Nefesh mean?
And then Marat Nefesh, so she's already coming into this in like just.
What does Marat Nefesh mean?
State of mind, a bitter soul.
Literally bitter spirit, but Marat Nefesh is a code phrase. We saw it not that long ago in Shoftim.
Yeah, the Klishtim wives, right?
Not wives. Marat Nefesh was a phrase that we used in Shoftim towards the end of Shoftim. So we're going to come back and see it, because that's very important.
Did they say that about Esau's wives, that they were...
No, they made...
She was
made
by her. It's like a
great...
Right. So she was a bitter spirit.
A bitter spirit. So we have to see what that means.
Well, why did she decide to dump him this year? We don't know what happened this year.
Just that this year, Pnina really got her. Something. I mean, if you're going to credit Penina, then that's
or
what your credit is.
Can you say, like, in here they say she did eat and drink. So perhaps.
Who said she didn't drink?
She went.
It's not. It's. I don't know where they're basing it on, but take a look at the end of the story.
She ate and drank, but she was not consoled. So can you say that?
I understand exactly what it said, but look at the end of the story. Look what happens.
I have drunk no wine.
Yeah,
she
says explicitly, I have not had anything to drink in Pasuk Tezvah. That's number one. That's sentence 15. And number two, if you look at Pasuk Yud Ches, after Eli gives her a bracha, she says, "May my maid find favor in your eyes." She goes home, and she ate. So I don't know where they're getting that from, but I think I have Chana's word that she didn't drink.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They're posting because
so
after they had eaten, including
Chana. I understand, but she didn't.
Is that then saying, like Yom Kippur, that you go empty to be at your basis level?
There's a Yom Kippur element to going there starving. We usually connect her with Rosh Hashanah, for reasons that we'll get to eventually. But there is, I think, that sense of, yeah, you're going with an empty stomach. You're going in with this kind of level of need. Also true. So there are a few things here. Go back to Pasuk Tes. It's not going to be relevant for today, but I want to make sure that you note it. What is here that doesn't need to be here? What's this business? And not only do we know that Eli is there, but we know that he's sitting on the chair. And not only do we know he's sitting on the chair, but he's sitting on the chair next to the doorpost.
You need to know he's there. You need to know he's there. You have to know.
Yes, because there's going to be a conversation. And you need to know it's the Mishkan, because that's why he'll be upset that she's drunk.
Well, and then he could see her.
And then he could see
her. And he could see that she was not saying words, right? Like she was close enough for that.
And you especially need to know that he's sitting on a chair.
But also it says in the substance can't be four that Chavi and Pinchas
stay on the floor. He's
like, it said that Chavi and Pinchas were there, so now maybe we have to say no, but Eli was there too. They were the Kohanim, because we said they were the Kohanim.
Yeah.
But it doesn't say that she's aware of him, so it could be that he happened to be there, but it's also like, I don't think it's to show he wasn't spying on her and to introduce why that he happened to be there before.
Right.
So he didn't follow her in, so it was nothing Sanua, not, you know.
You don't sit on chairs inside. Yeah, you can't sit. Only the king is able to sit inside the base of English.
So that's maybe why he's at the door.
So that's why he'll be sitting outside. Could be. Also, Eli is already, we see later in the story, Eli is very aged, and he's no longer able to run the show. That's why his kids are running the Mishkan.
So, can he see well?
He can't see well.
Well, that's
that'll come up later as well. So
is he also not being a little judgmental to her?
Oh, we're not there yet. No, it's a good question, but we're not there yet. So hold off on that until we get to Eli properly. But another thing that's odd, in Pasuk Yud, the description of her prayer, what's strange?
It says that you pray Al Hashem, not El Hashem.
Right. What does that mean? But to pray Al Hashem. So this could be a support for the Nefesh HaChaim's read. She's davening about God. Not to God, but saying, God, you need to allay my pains that your pain will be allayed. It's about to call Al Hashem. However, Al is often an aggressive term. And that's what we're going to come back to.
Like falling upon God?
Vatikahel ha'eda al Aharon. The nation gathered against, upon Aharon. There's an element potentially here of hostility.
Oh, I see.
That's I think an important point. Also, in Pasuk Yud Aleph, Hashem Tzvakos, Imra O Sir E Ba'ani Amasecha. Those who have translations here, Imra O Sir E is translated how? Art scrolls?
If you take note.
Imra O Sir E, if you take note. JPS?
If you will look upon the suffering.
If you will look upon, okay. That doesn't really add much to it. The current one, Debbie.
Indeed, look on the affliction of thy handmaid and remember me.
Interesting. Indeed, look upon the affliction. Where did the indeed come from?
The double language.
In other words, ra'ot yir'eh, very often we see this in Chumash in particular, that if there's a double verb, it means to say surely. There's strength to it. Im shamoa tishma is an example, or shamoa tishmu. That's an example of it. When you see a double verb, it's usually meant to indicate force.
Emphasis.
Mm-hmm. So we need to know what that's about.
Aggressive, you're saying. That's
so there may be. Here's an interesting thing. Ubachosiv ka, right? That's another double.
But maybe it's also, I think, sort of, that could be.
Yes, you don't do.
That, you know, you're looking bad, yeah, God. Like, I don't want the kid for me. If you don't forget me and you just do this. Like, why haven't you done this already? You're supposed to create this greatness, and this is this kid, and you haven't done so. What's your problem?
Yeah.
Come on.
No, it's true. And then in Pasuk Yud Aleph, here's an interesting point, which goes back to a theme that I mentioned a few times in Shoftim, but couldn't really wrap my mind around in terms of what it's meant to teach us. Remember we talked about the dynamics of parents and children in Sefer Shoftim? We talked about Yiftach and his daughter as, you know, as one example, but Gidon and his firstborn, who he wants to have chop off the head of the enemy, and the son refuses, right? You had Abimelech, who is the son of Gidon, and he kills his brothers, and he wants to be king. You had, I think it was Yair, who was the one who had the 30 kids riding on the 30 horses or fine donkeys, and he's trying to groom them to be the leaders of a nation. You had Shimshon and his mother, right, where his mother dedicates him as a Nazir. There was a lot going on between parents and children in Sefer Shoftim, frankly, more than you see in Chumash. You know, people, from time to time I get requests, can you do a parenting class based on Chumash? And the truth of the matter is you have an awful lot of questionable role models in there. Well, let's see, there's Avram who wants to kill him. is Yishmael getting thrown out of the house? It's hard. You don't get enough information in Chumash to really say this is a doctrine of parenting. And I feel like all the attempts that I've heard of trying to learn parenting from the Chumash tend to be sort of retrofitting ideas that we have elsewhere and saying, well, you can see this in the Chumash if you look at this. And I don't find them to be terribly consistent. But in Shoftim, you actually have quite a bit on the parent-child dynamic and where it works and where it doesn't work. And I say all of this to build to what's going on here in our story, where she just decided that the kid who doesn't even exist yet is going to be a Nazir his whole life. Does he get a say?
Isn't that like Shimshon also?
Shimshon
was told.
Yeah, but Shimshon, his mother is told by the Malach, this is what he's going to be.
Right?
It's the Malach's fault. If he grows up and he's in therapy because his mother did this to him, you know, the answer is, but it was the Malach who did it. It wasn't my fault. Here, this is her. She volunteered this.
Because she's an unborn child.
Because
she's a
Nazi.
She knew he's supposed to happen, so maybe she's crying because, like, why hasn't this happened? This is a great person.
Because she's desperate.
I just think it's really interesting. Not to mention, from a halachic perspective, she does not have the authority to do this. From a halachic perspective, a mother cannot make her kid a Nazir. You can't take a neder for the kid. It doesn't work that way.
She's also assuming that he'll be male.
Why? Why do you say that?
Because she wouldn't...
A woman can be a Nazir. There is such a thing as a Nazir. Yeah. She words it in a masculine, but again, you need a pronoun. The Torah says it explicitly, Isha, Isha. It's not...
Are there, you know, can you name one, Nazira?
You name
famous
it as
you one, are, like
no.
Famous one. Yeah.
No.
Not that I would know, you know, like
no.
Not the little one,
or the big one.
No, I can't name one. But how many Nazirim do we know of?
So we know though. Like I
what's
heard,
that
heard of
it.
Shimshon.
Who
was on your list?
Shimshon,
Shmuel, and Avshalom. There are some anonymous. You know, like the text talks about how you gave the Nazirim wine. But number one, I don't know if they're male versus female. Nazirim is just the plural that we're using. And it's not like there's anyone named. In other words, there were other people who took these vows. But in terms of figures who actually are Nazirim, there's one who's mentioned in the Gemara. He's anonymous. But he meets one of the Tanoim and he says, why did you do this to yourself? And you have to cut off your hair. And he says, because I was I was narcissistic, and so I felt like I needed this to get myself away from worrying about my beauty, so I figured I'll become a Nazir, so he has to grow his hair really long, and it's unkempt, and it doesn't look nice, and then he has to shave it all off at the end, but he's anonymous. Like, we just know there was someone who did it. So we don't find Nazirim running around in general. But yeah, I can't think of a single case of a Nazira. I mean, I'm tempted to say Yiftach's daughter may have become one, but I have no basis for that whatsoever.
What's that? Sorry?
Yiftach's daughter. But I have no basis for that. I have as much basis for that as the author of the book has for the book about her. Yeah.
Was it customary for women to be able to daven in the Mishkan? I would think it was mainly men who would go into the Mishkan.
Well, first of all, she's at the entrance. Note that she's at the entrance, but no, there were women who came to the Mishkan. Yes. If you go back to the Chumash, where they built the Mishkan originally, so they made the kior out of the Marot Hatzavot, the Petach HaMoed, out of the mirror, hang on, of the mirrors of the women who congregated at the entrance to the Ohel Moed. And Ibn Ezra says, these were women who said, we're out here in the Midbar, in the wilderness. We are not interested in pursuing sort of standard, you know, day-to-day life. We want to come learn Torah at the Mishkan, and we have no need for these mirrors anymore, so we're dedicating them for the Kiyor. That's Ibn Ezra on that, on the Marot Hatzavot. But even without Ibn Ezra, just the fact that it says the women who congregated at the entrance to the Ohel Moed, it doesn't sound like they're, I don't know what they're doing at the entrance. Yeah.
Other than Eli being at the entrance and seeing her, how do we know she was at the Mishkan? It doesn't specifically.
No, we know it because of that.
That's
how we know it. I mean, you're going to see it elsewhere also within this, within the story.
She could have been sitting at the entrance and she could have, I'm just playing devil's advocate, being on the steps.
Yeah, but I don't.
That she went there. Like, it doesn't specifically say, and it's very specific about.
Yeah, no. I mean, to me, that's what's going on. But I understand what you're saying. But yeah,
it's also strange—a woman who wanted a child so badly that she's literally giving him up.
Mm-hmm.
So she wanted the child for the sake of having a child, or
no? She wants the child for God.
That's
she wants the child for God, right? So let's talk about Hannah's tefillah. Let's talk about this prayer. So first of all, this becomes an important prayer for us because it succeeds. Right? We like prayers that succeed. And if we see something works, we say, let's do that ourselves. So take a look at source number 3, where the Gemara says, we deduce 3 halachos from her tefillah. Amar Rav Hamnuna. Rav Hamnuna says, Kama hechasa gibarvasa iko lemishma mehani kroy dechano. He says, look how many great halachos we learn from these psukim regarding Chana, the text regarding Chana. V'chana hi medaberes al liba. It says Chana spoke upon her heart. Mikam mispalel tsarich sheyachaben libo. That teaches us that when you pray, you have to focus your heart. You can't just, you know, say words that are in front of you. Kavana is necessary. Focus is necessary. Now you'll say to me, well, I mean, is that a chiddush? Is that like a novelty that you need to concentrate? No. But we're trying to show, look, this is what Chana did, and it paid off. The text says, only her lips moved. We haven't seen this yet, by the way. This is going to be when we talk about Eli's response to her. But only her lips moved. That teaches you that you have to form the words with your lips, meaning it isn't enough to stand there with a sitter looking at the words, you have to say the words. Whether someone's davening in any language, they have to actually say the words, right? Why is there value in speaking the words as opposed to just thinking it? Internalizing it, concretizing it, you process it to a greater extent when you have to actually form the words. It's much more meaningful. V'kolama yishama, her voice is not audible. Mikan she'asur lagbia kolo v'tfiloso. So from this we understand that you have to also, you're not supposed to keep an elevated, lo yishamei, actually, not lo yishama. That you're not supposed to elevate your voice, but that you should make sure that you're quiet in davening. Why quiet? So I think I'm actually going to get to that, although probably not this week. I think next week. I just want to make sure it's in the notes. Yeah, I have it in my notes. So we'll get to the question of silent davening. But what we're seeing right now, and this is what I wanted you to catch here, is that we use this tefillah, this prayer, as a basis for what we do. There's one additional halacha that's learned from here. I didn't bring it to you from the Gemara. And that is that also when you daven, you should not be intoxicated. As evidenced by what Eli says to her and then her response. That she hasn't drunk anything. Well, that's a whole other discussion. But the answer is yes.
Yes, we should.
Yes. We actually have, I'll advertise now, July 1st, Sunday, July 1st is, you know, Sunday in Canada Day, Shabbat Sabbat Tammuz, fasting. So our Beit Midrash is doing a morning of learning. It'll be at our Chaim. It's open to everybody. And it's going to be on the Haftarot of the 3 weeks, and then Nachamu. So it's half-hour classes. So it runs from 10 a.m. to noon, and it's just 4 half-hour classes. and the idea is to introduce the Haftarot. So just, this comes up because of what Sandy said, because I wanted the tagline on the banner to the, what happened when you were out at Kiddush Kol.
Oh, no.
The, I chose not, but that was the...
Can you get some emails on that?
I don't mind the emails. If it gets people to notice it, that's great.
They wouldn't attend.
They missed the Haftarot.
Maybe they didn't come because they were missing it.
Yeah, this is what we don't get to hear. I don't know. Okay. So this is Chana's. All right, you can have a flyer with that as the tagline. this is our introduction to Chana's effective tefillah. But now we get into the aggressive character of it. Take a look at source number 4. The Gemara picks up on these points that we make. This is the Gemara that is really about aggressive tefillah, not just for Chana, but also about two others in Tanakh. V'amar Rabbi Elazar, Chana hiticha devarim klape mala. That's the phrase that Reb Chaim Volozhin pointed out in Nefesh HaChaim, that she launched words heavenward. Now, Nefesh HaChaim took it as a positive, meaning she throws up her pain on God's pain. She says, God, I'm in pain, and therefore you're in pain. That's not the way that most people read the Gemara. Rather, the way it's read is, hiticha is like to shoot an arrow, that she's actually aggressive, she's attacking God. The Shneamar, because the Pasuk says, as we noted, batitpaleil al Hashem. She prayed upon God, melamei she ticha devarim klape mala, that she launched words heavenward. And lest you say, well, I don't know for sure that that's aggressive, look at the other two examples that it brings. V'amar Rabbi Elazar. Rabbi Elazar quotes you from the story of Eliyahu, not Har Carmel, after Har Carmel. No, sorry, this is at Har Carmel. This is. Remember the story. Eliyahu has a showdown with the prophets of the Baal. You bring your animal, I bring my animal, let's see which one gets fire coming down from heaven to consume it. They try to get God to respond, or their God to respond to them, nothing doing. And then Eliyahu with his prayer, look what he says. Eliyahu itiach tevarim klape mala, Eliyahu launched words heavenward, shnemar, because he said, ve'ata hasibosa es libam achoranit. You, God, turned their hearts back. You want to know why it is that people are following the Baal? It's your fault, God, because you have not made yourself manifest. And in fact, Rabbi Shmuel Bar Yitzchak goes on to say that Hashem agreed with him because of a pasuk in Micha where he says, Asher harayosi, I made them rot, is the way the Gemara is reading it. But I'm jumping over that to the third example. V'amar Rabbi Elazar, if you're in the Hebrew, it's the middle of the third line. Rabbi Elazar also said, Moshe hitiach devarim klape mala. Moshe launches words at God as well, and this is after the egel, after the golden calf. Shneamar, as the pasuk says, Vayispalil Moshe el Hashem, Moshe davened to God, but the Gemara says, no, make it like Chana. Al tikri el Hashem, ela al Hashem. You should read it as prayer upon God. What do you mean? Devei Rabbi Yanai Amri Mehacha. Different figures in the Gemara give different sources, but I brought this one in particular. They said in the Yeshiva of Rabbi Yanai, in the beginning of Sefer Devarim, we're told that this is the speech that Moshe gave before they crossed the Yarden, and it mentions a whole bunch of places. The other places that are in the Pasuk, by and large, we know where they are. We have no idea, there's no other reference to a place that the Jews traveled that's called Dizahav. But we just don't know of one. So the Gemara says it isn't actually a place. It's an argument. V'dizahav is v'day zahav. Day means enough. Enough gold. So he says, Amri Dvera Biyanai, Kach Amar Moshe Lefnei HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Moshe said to God, Ribono Shel Olam, Bishvil Kesef V'Zav Sheshfata Lahem LeYisrael Ad She'amru Dai, Hu Garam She'asu Es HaEgel. You gave them so much silver and gold that they said enough already. That's why they made the golden calf, which is expanded upon in the Gemara elsewhere, where the Gemara, actually no, not elsewhere, in that Gemara in Brachos, with the idea that Moshe says to Hashem, look, you gave them all this gold. You abandoned them for 6 weeks in the wilderness without their leader. What did you think was going to happen?
Blaming God for the golden calf.
Yes. That
sounds like
that's exactly what he is.
Wow.
That's why I say to you that, you know, Nefesh HaChaim's reading you know, look, Chaim Volozhin is one of the greatest Talmidei Chacham ever. At the same time, the usual way this Gemara is read is that Chana, like Eliyahu, like Moshe, is being very aggressive towards God with this tefillah and making demands effectively. How does the Gemara know she was aggressive? So part is Batit Palel Al Hashem, right? That's one. But go back to Pasuk Vav. Remember what we said with Penina torturing Chana, Ba'avur Har'ima. And we said Har'ima from Ra'am, to make her thunder. That's what we're seeing here. And it's also supported by that phrase that we ask about in Pasuk Yud, Vihi Maras Nafesh. What does it mean to be Mar Nefesh? So take a look at number 5, where I gave you 4 references where this comes up. Mar Nefesh. The first one is the one I was referring to from Shoftim. This was the story of Pesel Micha. Right? I'm not going through the entire weird story, but at one point in the story, there is a gentleman named Micha who has an idol, and he has, whether it's fully an idol or quasi-idol, it doesn't matter for our purposes, he has a Levi who he has made a Kohen to go work for it, and then along come the people of the tribe of Dan, and they say, ha, neat idol, we like to take that with us. And the Kohen, Levi, whatever he is, comes out of the house and says, hey, what are you doing? And they say, oh, you should come with us. It'll be an upgrade. Right now, you're just the priest for whoever's around locally. Now you'll be the priest for an entire tribe. And he says, great. And he starts going. And then Micha comes out of his house. And he sees what's going on. And he says, hey, wait, stop. And they say, look, pal, you know, these are people who are mar nefesh, a bitter spirit. Close your mouth now and you'll be safe. It's a threat, is what they say to him. To be mar nefesh isn't just an expression of bitter spirit like she's suffering. It's a dangerous person. Somebody who can turn around and attack. And you see it in Shmuel as well. Sorry. God. That's the idea. God first in a second. Take a look at Perek Chav Bet, chapter 22, sentence 2. I gave you the reference on the sheet also. You can see it there. This is when David has run away, right? David is a fugitive. You see it? Vayiskavtzu elav, and they gathered to him, called ish matzok, people who were under duress, people who had troubles. V'chol ish asher lo noshe, anybody who had a lender, somebody owed money to somebody. V'chol ish mar nefesh, as well as the people who were mar nefesh. These are wild people. These are dangerous people. And then if you jump to Perek Lamed Pasuk Vav, right? In this story here, this is when Amalek has attacked. David is out of the city of Ziklag with his men. Amalek attacks, and they destroy the city, and they take the women hostage, and including 2 wives of David. And Pasuk Vav, Vatetzer leDavid me'od. David is very upset. Ki amru ha'am l'soklo. All the people want to stone him. Ki mara nefesh kol ha'am. Because the entire nation is, again, of bitter spirits. They're all upset, and the result is that they are hostile. They wish to attack. Mar nefesh in all of these. And then the last one is in Shmuel Bet. For those who have it with them, they could. But that's talking about David's warriors. That's when Avshalom has started his rebellion against David. And Achitophel says to Avshalom, you should go on the attack right away to get rid of David. And Hushai counters Achitophel's advice. And Hushai says, no, don't attack right now. David and his men are really dangerous. And if you corner them now, you're going to get hurt. And he says, David's men are Mare Nefesh. Uses the same term. And my point is, these phrases are all used by one man. Right? Shmuel wrote Shoftim, and Shmuel writes Sefer Shmuel. So he uses this phrase consistently.
So he must mean that at the time he writes about Chana, that's it, right?
Exactly.
That's the connotation later on.
Yep.
This kind of phrase, it really seems to indicate thundering and like just anger boiling over, and you would expect something like someone like that to run in and scream in rage, not 50,000 quietly.
So, there's the silence bothers you then.
Yeah.
Why is this silent? So we're going to come back to silence and why silence is important, because you're right, it's counterintuitive.
If someone really this angry, if they open their mouth, what would you expect to come out?
Right. So, well, we'll see.
Thunder is
not.
No, unless she's so angry that...
Sometimes it's just that you see them fight.
I mean, it's a good question. We'll come back to it.
But it doesn't mean that this happened directly before she actually walks to the...
Well, the opening part is a description of what happened annually, that she's bitter annually. That's true.
Naomi also refers to herself as bitter.
Well, she says, Karenali Mara. Call me bitter.
Shmuel's work, which is also...
Right. Rose is also Shmuel's work. Correct. She doesn't say Mar Nefesh, but you're right.
She uses the word bitter.
Right. The, then you have the double language of Ra'o Tir'eh and Bacho Tivkeh. Right, which again connotes force. Something that is doubled is forceful. And then one other note: it's been mentioned. A few people pointed out. Ricky pointed out. A few others that her vow is aggressive. She asks for a lot. Right. Take a look at this Medrash I brought you at number 6. Medrash Shmuel, Beis Aleph. Anochi Hashem Elokecha Hamalcha Me'eretz Mitzrayim Harchev Picha Va'amaleihu. I am Hashem who took you out of Egypt. Open your mouth wide, and I will fill it. So on that pasuk from Tehillim, the Gemara says, Rabbi Chagai says, B'shem Rabbi Yitzchak, Ein shol en anius b'makom ashirus. You don't ask for poverty in a place of wealth. Meaning, you're talking to God. God can provide everything, so don't go small. Right? Imkar azkvar. As you said. That's why Chana takes her vow. She's making this a high stakes, I don't want to call it game to minimize it. But that's the idea, and you see it last in Pasuk Yud Beis, here Betalihit Palel. She davened a lot. This wasn't a momentary thing. This is, she's going on with this. So the question is, what is this hiticha dvarim klape mala? Now that I know that she's aggressive, right, the way we usually take that Gemara, and now that I've seen the anchors for it in the psukim, what exactly did she say? We don't really know. All we have, the only words we have are for the neder, for the vow. But for vatit palel al Hashem, I don't know what the words were. So they, so we find a few different attempts by commentators to explain what it was that she said. Really, the main focus is the Gemara. But before we get to the Gemara, we'll just see the Tzlach, the Tzion the Nefesh Chaya, by Rabbi Yechezkel Landau. And the next time we'll see the Gemara. But he says, Veli Nira, it appears to me, Ba'omra al Hashem, when it says that she davened upon God, Ritzona Bazeh, what she wanted to say, you know what, I see we only have a couple of minutes left. So I think what I'll do is I'll say it outside, but you can see it in the text. He says, the Gemara in Moed Katan says that there are three things that aren't about how good a person you are. They're about mazel. Bane chaye umezone. Bane means your children. Chaye, how long a person lives. And mezone, parnasa. Now, once the Gemara says that, is that serious? Like, that's it? I shouldn't bother davening for any of those things? Because, whatever, it's just mazel anyway. So he says, no, that's not the idea. And he says, as I translated for you here, this doesn't mean that God lacks the ability to overpower mazel. Mazel is shorthand for, it's just natural forces. In their day, astrology...
But mazel is the constellation.
Correct,
so
it's just
an auspicious... It's more like mazal tov may be an auspicious.
So mazal to them is science. What it is natural forces that frame what's going on in the world. They did not view mazal in the way that people today think of it. They viewed mazal as the forces that influence the world, what we think of in terms of gravity, electromagnetic, and things like that. Like that's what they believed was happening in under the influence of stars and planets. So, but what he says is, it doesn't mean that Hashem can't overpower it, but you require great merit in order to do so. Like when Hashem says to Abraham, go out, he says to him. So the Medrash says, leave your itzdagninut. Leave your astrology. That doesn't control you. So Chana says to God in this version of what she's doing, God, if you don't provide a child for me, people are going to think it's because you can't. You know, because look, everybody knows I'm righteous, and here I am turning to you for a child. People are just going to assume that you're not capable, God.
So where is
that what you want?
Where is that?
Source number 7.
It's almost close.
Oh, so it's not.
No, it's an explanation of what the Gemara means when it says that she was hurling words or launching words at God. She's saying, look, God, you know, it's up to you. What do you want people to say about you? What do you want your legacy to be?
So funny.
She's desperate.
So, well, here's an interesting thing, because once someone said that to me, that you know, she's so aggressive because she's desperate. But the truth is, I think people who are desperate tend to plead, not to attack.
Right.
What's that?
You know, people who are desperate plead. They don't attack. Mm-hmm. I feel like this is part of her confidence that Hashem can do anything, and so she's saying, so do it.
She's,
you know?
Blackmailing him.
And then, oh, you'll see that next week. No, I'm not kidding. Next week you will see exactly that. When we see 8 and 9. So there's more to be said. God willing, we'll pick up with that next week.